It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Senator Tammy Baldwin tells us about the $1 billion+ in federal funding Wisconsin is set to receive to improve access to high-speed internet connections. First, Wagner mercenary group Yevgeny Prigozhin is now living in exile after an apparent attempted mutiny against Russia's military. This comes as American officials say at least one Russian general knew ahead of time about the rebellion plans. That general hasn't been seen publicly for close to a week. All this comes as Ukrainian forces are in the midst of their planned counteroffensive aimed at retaking eastern parts of the country. We're talking now about what just happened, what we do and don't know, and what it all means for the continued Russian occupation of parts of Ukraine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about this weekend's events and what they mean? Were you following this in real time? And like many people, were you confused by what happened, what came out of it? What would you like to know about the attempted apparent mutiny? And what role, if any, should the U.S. play in supporting Ukrainian resistance against the Russian military? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Mikhail Troyetsky is a professor of practice in the political science department at UW-Madison. Mikhail, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. Good afternoon, everyone.
Can you talk about, first of all, the unique role of this Wagner military mercenary group, but obviously closely affiliated with Russia? Can you give us a little of their history?
Well, I think the background to mention here is that the Wagner group was created some 10 years ago to give Russia deniability in its operations in eastern Ukraine during the initial stage of the invasion, when Russian forces helped two Ukrainian provinces de facto secede from Ukraine. And President Putin wanted deniability. He didn't want to accept Russia or its military was there in eastern Ukraine. So I think that was when the idea came up of establishing a private military company. But later on, as time went by, I think the Russian government figured out that it was quite useful. The PMC was quite useful in kind of shadow operations in other places as well, primarily Central and Northern Africa, where, again, Russia could stay under the radar as a country and yet have its military that de facto reported to the Russian general staff just, you know, conduct operations, maybe prop up some local regimes or anti-regime forces, depending on who the Russian government wanted to win in the manifold conflicts in Africa. So that was how the Wagner Group came into prominence. As the fighting in Ukraine was raging after the February 2022 invasion, Wagner also turned out to be in demand given the problems faced by the Russian military. So the ruthless, but still very well-trained fighters were found quite useful, again, as a supporting force for the Russian uniformed military during their war in Ukraine.
Now, here we are last weekend. The leader of this military mercenary group, Yevgeny Prigozhin, criticizes more than he had before the Russian military, criticized the grounds for the invasion, the full invasion of Ukraine, turns his troops down the highway toward Moscow, then stops. Now, there's a lot of speculation. Mal, what do we know about what led to that? What do we know for sure about his motivations in doing this?
Well, I think we have enough evidence to perhaps suggest that the Kremlin and President Vladimir Putin personally was growing unhappy with Prigozhin and the Wagner Group as this maverick force that was getting public traction. And with Prigozhin, coming up with all those statements blaming the Russian top commanders for failing to support his very effective men in their assault in a Ukrainian city that apparently Putin wanted to seize. So Prigozhin's public prominence was kind of unpleasant to Putin and the Kremlin. So they decided to deal with him somehow, marginalize him, and then perhaps also destroy him and part of his fighters physically. So at that point, I think Prigozhin, who likely was tipped off about that plot by the Kremlin, decided to just to rebel. He had little, if anything, to lose, and apparently he also enjoyed support and at the very least sympathies among some Russian military commanders, including high-ranking generals. And he also was getting traction among the rank-and-file military, among the soldiers fighting on the battlefront. And so he just went ahead and seized a major Russian city in the south, out of which much of Russia's campaign, military campaign in Ukraine, is being run. And then he staged a march on Moscow, aborting it at some point, being quite close to Moscow when it became clear that his mercenaries will most likely have to fight their way into Moscow. And apparently, amid some defections or dissatisfaction among his men, who didn't want to just, you know, fight against Putin's forces, that wasn't their agenda, that wasn't their platform. And then, as long as Putin himself and his associates were afraid of what could happen, Prigozhin proved able to bail himself out of that situation and was allowed to escape unscathed to Belarus, whose president offered him asylum. And apparently some other Wagner commanders and maybe even troops are with Prigozhin in Belarus right now. That is as much as we know. We also hear from the US media that some of the generals that are being suspected of sympathizing and maybe even abetting Prigozhin's mutiny have been followed up with and have been apparently interrogated, maybe even kept in custody. So there's some kind of a purge or at least a reckoning going on in Moscow and elsewhere among the Russian military and more broadly the state apparatus in the aftermath of that coup that apparently proved quite divisive for the military and also the Russian bureaucracy.
We're talking about the events in Russia last week. The uprising by the Wagner mercenary group quickly dissipated. Mikhail Troitsky is with us, Russia expert at UW-Madison. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. If you're wondering what happened next with this mutiny in the aftermath, wider thoughts on the U.S. role supporting Ukraine against the invasion, call 800-642-1234. Mikhail, a lot of people have pointed out that, okay, we have this armed revolt for a little while. We didn't see Russian people rising up in support of it. Also didn't see Russian people particularly rising up in support of Putin in the face of what he said was effectively an emergency, the risk of civil war. What do you make of the non-public response from the Russian public here?
Well, I think Prigozhin may have counted on broader public support and enthusiasm and some political momentum that this show of public support could have generated. But in Russia these days, apparently the majority of the population kind of is sitting on the fence. They do not fiercely support Russia's war effort in Ukraine, but neither are they excited about Russia just retreating, acknowledging defeat, pulling out of Ukraine. So those people like Prigozhin as someone who probably just made a difference. He went on the record complaining about the problems with the Russian military. And apparently many people think that the Russian military has been underperforming in Ukraine. So Prigozhin was kind of giving the system a shake. And he also was and is a very apt public relations figure. So he actually went on a tour, on a PR tour around Russia, making his case in front of audiences in a number of major Russian cities. So he was getting public traction, which kind of explains some of the display of public support, especially in the city of Rostov that Wagner forces captured early in the mutiny. But otherwise, no one in Moscow, for example, was getting out in the streets, you know, preparing to cheer Wagner troops as they would be entering the city. And of course, Prigozhin is a very controversial figure for many people, especially Moscow residents. Prigozhin is a ruthless warlord whose forces committed many documented, you know, war crimes and atrocities. So that kind of figure was, you know, would inevitably be very divisive and controversial for the Russians, even those who think that Putin is either underperforming in the war against Ukraine or has run his course as Russia's president and has to go because he's, you know, a dictator, undemocratic, is waging a criminal war, and so forth. So Prigozhin, he and whatever political ideas he kind of was hinting at were not sufficient, apparently, to rally support for him among the Russian public and apparently also the military on whose defections he could have probably been counting.
Let's bring on a caller. Jeff is with us in Dubuque. Jeff, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. And my question involves military tactics. When the Wagner Group headed up towards Moscow, would that not have been an opportunity to grant them a temporary ceasefire, enabling them to leave their positions in Ukraine to join that group as they're heading towards Moscow and to be filled by the Ukrainians?
Interesting question, Jeff. Now, Mikhail, as I understand it, after the fighting in Bakhmut, the Wagner Group mostly had withdrawn from the front lines to be replaced by Russian soldiers. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I think so. The Wagner Group had to pull out. Well, they actually volunteered to pull out. They announced their withdrawal from the front lines, and they were based in some field camps around the city of Rostov and also in the Ukrainian territories that Russia annexed since the start of the war. So they were apparently no longer involved in the fighting at the time of the mutiny, which basically freed up their hands to just make a raid on Rostov and then head towards Moscow.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Interesting question. Mikhail Troitsky is with us, professor of practice in the political science department at UW-Madison. We're looking at the latest in the Russian invasion of Ukraine, including the apparent mutiny that stalled last weekend and what happens after. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the latest news in that war? Do you have thoughts on American support for Ukraine? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our conversation with Mikhail Troitsky, professor of practice in the political science department at UW-Madison, looking at the attempted mutiny in Russia by mercenary forces there, the ensuing fallout, and in general, the latest status of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. That's 800-642-1234. Mikhail, a big question now is, does this mutiny in any way weaken Russia's military in its ongoing efforts in Ukraine, or are the troops on the front line not looking over their shoulders at what's going on here? It might be a while before we have a real answer to that question. What are you watching for?
Yeah, I think clearly the Bortiv mutiny highlighted at least some divisions within the Russian military. And I believe also state bureaucracy, high-ranking officials, some of whom may well have been wishing Prigozhin well and the success in his coup attempt. We also saw President Putin just delivering one brief address, short of fiery rhetoric, just, you know, kind of condemnation, a moderate condemnation of Prigozhin and his forces. So he apparently was afraid of going all in, maybe hedging some of his bets. And eventually, as we saw, the coup ended with some kind of a compromise, not with a destruction of Wagner and Prigozhin, which may have been planned before the coup started, actually triggering that coup attempt. That said, of course, the Russian military are likely operating pretty much autonomously from the politics that is going on in Moscow and Russia in general. So the commanders are still there, and you know, the whole organization of the troops and their tactics and their plans may have not been affected. That said, again, the questions with respect to the decisions that were being made and the resolve that the Russian government has to persist in that war have indeed come into question as a result of that coup.
We heard from Bobby in Madison, who wonders if the Belarusian president is allies with Putin, why would he let Prigozhin and, as you said, officers and maybe troops come into Belarus? What do we know about the Belarusian leader's angle on this?
Well, I think for Putin and the Kremlin, it was the best bet to actually have give Prigozhin an off-ramp. And if you are Putin, and if you think about what kind of off-ramp may be available, you immediately think about your ally Lukashenko in Belarus, and you just ask him if he would be amenable to a solution whereby he gives temporary asylum to Prigozhin and some of his mercenary commanders so that you can deal with them later in Belarus or elsewhere. And, you know, Lukashenko is happy to oblige. This does not pose major threats to his rule in Belarus, and maybe even gives him some leeway if he is able to just make good friends with those troops. He may later on use the mercenaries in certain situations whenever his, you know, grip on power is threatened, for example. So that could look like a good opportunity for Lukashenko as well. This is how I see it. But again, too many balls are in the air, and we really don't know now how it's going to play out. Too many moving parts.
Mihail, I wanted to ask about American and Western European support from Ukraine. We've seen a steady leveling up of the kinds of weaponry supplied, from handheld items to more and more larger and more sophisticated piece of equipment. Now reports that the U.S. is looking at granting a longer range missiles than we were willing to in the past. Just your thoughts on the significance of that material support for the Ukrainian military.
Well, at least the Ukrainian side has long been suggesting that this longer-range artillery could be key to its efforts, you know, at a counteroffensive against the Russian forces. And it might well be true as long as Ukraine may be able to strike Crimea from the current Ukrainian positions, and you know, destabilize the situation in Crimea for the Russians, that would be a very big deal. So on the US side, I think the takeaway from this abortive coup was that there just may be too many divisions within the Russian military. And there are some elements among the Russian military that may support ending the war, and that may be amenable to either negotiation or perhaps even a new coup that could, you know, destabilize this whole war effort. And in any case, you know, Moscow may not even have the guts to retaliate at this point, and that, of course, may have influenced this decision, or not yet a decision, but at least an advanced discussion of potential supplies of those shells, of those long-range artillery shells to Ukraine by the U.S.
Mikhail, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. My pleasure.
Mikhail Troyetsky is a professor of practice in the political science department at UW-Madison. He joined us for a look at the latest developments in the ongoing Russian invasion of Ukraine, including this apparent mutiny over the weekend by Russian mercenary troops. Beginning on July 1st, that's this Saturday, listeners to WPR at 90.9 FM in the Madison area, well, you'll want to set your radios to 90.5 FM to hear the Ideas Network. 90.9 FM is going to stop broadcasting, be replaced by a more powerful signal at 90.5. That station is going to carry the same content, but serve a larger area for listeners in South Central Wisconsin. Thanks for adjusting your radios to help WPR reach and serve more listeners in this part of the state. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to a historian about progress and pushback over the decades for LGBTQ acceptance. Now, Wisconsin will receive just over $1 billion in federal funding to expand access to high-speed internet in the state. The official amount was announced earlier this week. Most of that funding will go toward laying high-speed fiber optic cables. Other states are receiving funding as well, with the eventual goal of the whole country being connected by 2030. The funding comes from the Federal Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have access to high-speed internet in your part of the state? Has a lack of that kind of access affected your life, your business, your work, your kids' schooling? How would that kind of access change things for you? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Tammy Baldwin is a Democratic U.S. Senator from Wisconsin. She was there at the Wisconsin announcement. Senator Baldwin, welcome back to the show.
It's great to join you.
Now, this funding is allocated by the FCC, as I understand it, based on a national map of broadband access. You had joined some of your Senate colleagues from both parties saying, hey, update this map so we know where this money is going. Can you tell us about that effort?
Yes, you know, the original map produced by the Federal Communications Commission several years ago was wholly inadequate. You had parts of the state of Wisconsin that were viewed as having full service high-speed broadband when only a few households or businesses actually had that. But they did it by census tract, and if anyone had it, they said the whole tract had it. We required them to redo the maps, and the more recent map is certainly a huge improvement, but they have a process by which stakeholders can protest or raise concerns with the map's accuracy, and the FCC then has to update it. So While this is a greatly improved map of the country and identifying what areas are served, underserved, or unserved, there's still an opportunity to update the map as these funds are deployed to meet the needs, especially in places that have no high-speed broadband at all.
Who right now is most affected by a lack of access to that high-speed internet?
You know, there's two forms of lack of access. One is simply the infrastructure isn't there. There's not the access because they don't have the fiber laid in the ground. And so that's part of it. But another part is inaccessibility because of cost. The affordability just isn't there. A lot of people get their high-speed broadband, in a bundle with telephone and cable TV service. And I think most people know how expensive that can be. You can certainly get a package with just high-speed broadband, but for some, the access question is one of affordability, not one of infrastructure. And these funds are addressing both, but predominantly the bulk of these funds, the over $1 billion that Wisconsin has just been awarded, will go to putting fiber in the ground.
How much of the need will be met by this, as you say, just north of $1 billion?
The goal is all of the need will be met. The goal is that no one should be left behind or experience, the digital divide, because we know how important high-speed broadband is to the economy. It will really allow people to fully participate in the economy. Kids can get the education that they deserve. So much of homework and whatnot is done digitally these days. And then, just connectivity. Families can connect with their friends and loved ones. There's things like telehealth and other elements that are extremely important in this day and age. And so we hope to forever close the digital divide so that all Wisconsinites can participate fully in the economy.
I've seen some conservative think tanks here in Wisconsin saying, well, this is something the market should be providing, and the market will solve this problem. What's your answer to that?
Well, there's been many, many years for that to happen, and it hasn't. There are areas of the state that are sparsely populated, and the cost for a for-profit to run the fiber to the home, to the small business, they'll never recoup that investment. So they're not doing it on their own, and we need to make sure that, again, no one is left behind. And, I remember having roundtables throughout the state of Wisconsin over the past many years about the consequence of lack of broadband access. You hear from families during recent years that if they don't have broadband at home, the kids get loaded up in the car and they park outside a fast food restaurant or a library or a school where Wi-Fi will be strong and the kids can do their homework. That should not be the case in this day and age. And so this is going to be a real transformation over the next several years as these funds are deployed.
When will people first start to see broadband coming to their neck of the woods if they don't have it?
Yeah, so certainly there's efforts ongoing that predate this grant, but this grant will come in two phases. Right now, the state has 180 days to put in its initial plan for deployment of these funds. And at that point in time, after that plan is approved, and the state, by the way, has already been working on this, when that's approved, the first 20% of the funding will come through, and then the state will finalize a plan, and the remaining 80% will come through a couple of years from now. So it's going to be, deployed, over a course of a few years. This, by the way, is also going to put Wisconsinites to work. The bulk of this funding, as I said, is the infrastructure to bring high-speed broadband to folks. And so it's really, you know, getting that fiber laid. And that's going to require skilled tradespeople and create new jobs. But in addition, as I said, the work is ongoing now. There have been smaller amounts of funding from, say, the U.S. Department of Agriculture in their rural broadband program, you know, that have been helping expand access. But this is to finish the job.
Senator Baldwin, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure.
That was Tammy Baldwin, Democratic U.S. Senator from Wisconsin. I talked to her earlier today about new federal funding for broadband access expansion here in Wisconsin. Coming up, we'll hear more on that topic from the Public Service Commission of Wisconsin, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What has internet access been like for you living in Wisconsin? Do you have high-speed options? Do you have affordable high-speed options? Have things gotten better lately? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about federal funding for high-speed internet access, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have access to good internet in your home, or do you have to go elsewhere, a library or cafe maybe, to get it? How has lack of access to fast internet affected your life? Do you want to put in a pitch for some of that federal money we were just talking about to come to your neck of the woods? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We just heard from Senator Tammy Baldwin. Now Alyssa Kenny is with us, Broadband and Digital Equity Director for the Public Service Commission of Wisconsin. Alyssa, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, and have a good afternoon.
According to your organization, this federal money goes a long way. It's not quite all of what we would need to reach everybody with high-speed access. Can you talk about the difference?
Sure. So Wisconsin has a number of locations throughout the state that are what we would call unserved. And so those are the folks that have not, don't have 25.3, so 25 megabits down and 3 megabits up. And so the priority for these dollars will be to get all that group of locations and businesses dollars first. But there's also, there's another group, and that's sort of the in-between, the sort of just enough group. And that's the folks who have less than 100 megabits down and 20 megabits up. And so the goal with these dollars is to really focus first and foremost on those in the state that have that slowest performance, that are unserved by broadband. And then after we're really sure that all those people have access, to then work on that next group.
Can you talk a little more about geographically, socially, who is hardest hit by that lack of access?
So there's unserved and underserved locations in every single county in our state, every county. It largely is in our more rural areas, but sometimes there's suburban areas, you know, right outside of the edge of town. Even sometimes there's an urban area where that, you know, just a certain building or a small neighborhood or didn't get built. And so it's really sprinkled throughout the state. Certainly the northern half of the state has more unserved and more folks who have older internet service or older facilities. And so they have slower service in the northern half of the state. But it's in Dane County, it's in Brown County, every county throughout the entire state of Wisconsin has unserved and underserved locations that really need improvements with these federal funds.
And why is this seen? We heard a little bit from Senator Baldwin there. Why is this seen as an economic priority to get those people connected?
So the internet just opens up so many opportunities, and it's really just the gateway to society now. And so there's the economic opportunities, the educational opportunities. You know, it helps our small businesses throughout the state have access to that full global marketplace. It helps our farmers in the state have access to better data and make good use of precision agriculture. It helps our, you know, tourism communities have tourists stay longer and in many cases be safer because they don't get lost. And so it's really it's an economic driver for all of our small businesses, but just all for our individual Wisconsinites that live throughout the state. The internet really just opens up an entire window of new and important and critical economic opportunity.
It's Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Carter is with us in Hurley. Carter, hi.
Hi. How are you today?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, when all this fiber is put in and these providers have access to all this, is there any type of that where they have to pay back some of the money for the usage of all this fiber that's getting put in free for them?
Carter, thanks a lot for the call. That there are a number of questions, I think, potentially, Alyssa, about who are the providers who are going to put this in? Do they make money out of this public investment? Do they have to reimburse for any of this coming in? How does that all work?
Sure. So the federal BEAD program that Senator Baldwin just was announcing has a required minimum match of 25%. So any private entity or eligible entities that were building that would be putting some private dollars into the facility. But our office and the Public Service Commission, we work really, really hard to make sure we put only the sort of least right amount of public dollars in to help get that sort of very basic return on investment and make sure that all Wisconsinites are connected. And so they don't pay back the state for the grant dollars, but they do, but they provide a value, but they often provide match. They operate the facilities, they help with the construction costs, and then they manage, maintain, and own them.
Thanks a lot for that call, Carter. We're talking about federal funding for broadband internet expansion here in Wisconsin. Alyssa Kenny is with us with the Public Service Commission of Wisconsin. Still time for you to report on what's going on in your neck of the woods at 800-642-1234. We followed up with Dan Hudzinski. Now, he's a listener we talked to a couple of years back on our Wisconsin project. He'd been experiencing some personal and professional headaches around slow internet in rural Wisconsin. He said he lives between two municipalities that offer good speeds. He's only 1 to 3 miles from each, but can't tap into that. He updates us, quoting, "The T-Mobile home internet service has been great with good bandwidth, good pricing, and no outages. Couldn't be happier. And the telco, CenturyLink, did finally upgrade their local phone line-based service to 10 megabits per second, still lower than what the federal folks would consider as broadband." And I hear the suggestion sometimes, Alyssa, you know, forget the cables. We can get a good 5G home internet service. Why isn't that good enough?
So the 5G internet service is really most likely to help a lot of the people in the state that already have pretty good access to home broadband and not really reach those more heavily forested or glaciated or very rural and sparse areas. Because even a 5G service or a cellular service, you still need wires. There's still lots of fiber that feeds those towers, and you still need the infrastructure for that data, and you need a lot of towers and a lot of power. And so it's just it's not a solution for everybody, and it's not a solution that's really going to reach areas of our state with, you know, big, tall, gorgeous forests and pine trees that hold snow on them for many months of the year. And so really that wired or a fixed solution right to their home is going to be the most permanent and the most secure for the longest period of time. And that's really where the Biden administration is wanting states to invest their dollars in, that future-proof, long-term, solve the problem permanently types of solutions.
On the Ideas Network Facebook page, we heard from Mark, who raises concerns about the cost to do this and says Elon Musk's Starlink could do it for $5.99 per family. You don't have to wait 7 years. Another, again, non-cable option. What do you think about that idea of the Starlink project? I don't know how accessible it is here in Wisconsin at this point.
Sure, there are a number of locations for Starlink. Starlink's a low-orbit satellite, and we in our office have heard both great reviews about Starlink and also some really disappointing ones. And again, some of Starlink's performance is really related to how great your home's view of the sky is. And for some people in some areas of the state, that works well, and that's a reasonable and good solution. But the reality is it just leaves behind too many homes and too many businesses. And the goal of these dollars is really everyone and internet for all, not just internet for people who have enough view of the sky to get access.
I talked to Senator Baldwin a little bit about the timeline. From your perspective at the Public Service Commission, what are you guys doing? What is happening to get from here now with this announcement of this federal funding to digging and laying some fiber optic cable?
Well, what I want to start by saying is really in the state of Wisconsin, we have had our foot on the gas for this. Under Governor Evers' leadership, you know, in 2021, we had the year of broadband. We've already had federal dollars and significant state dollars deployed to broadband. And so we have a really ambitious grant program that's already underway. So we have a lot of locations that are under construction with public dollars already. And so there's a lot happening right now. But these next BEAD dollars, this is really our year of planning in 2023. And then we spend some time in next year going through some federal approvals of our plans. And it will take a while. Fiber and the preferred technology for these dollars, it's not instantaneous. It's not fast. And we're trying to reach hundreds of thousands of locations. And so there will be years. I think that that completion date of 2030, I think is realistic, but I know for families, this feels like an urgent need and it can't come soon enough.
Dr. Alyssa Kenny from the Public Service Commission of Wisconsin, looking at some new federal money, a lot of new federal money coming in over the next few years to try to get everybody connected to higher speed internet. Still time for you to report on your local situation. Your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Mike from St. Lawrence couldn't stay on the air, but he says he has Verizon Wireless and loses speed after a while. So he's finally investing in having cable put down, but it's expensive. Yeah. Do we see a lot of people saying, okay, I'm going to eat the cost of getting fiber optic to my house because it hasn't come down my street yet?
We do on occasion see people wanting to, you know, that they'll pay for like a line extension or the additional cost if they have an exceptionally long driveway. I will say broadband remains not regulated. And so sometimes there's even cases where a homeowner or a business owner wants to pay the cost to get connected, but it's, for whatever reason, the internet service provider is making the decision not to. And so in some cases, a homeowner can pay that additional cost and get connected, but there's lots of locations throughout the state where the facilities just aren't designed to extend down that driveway, or the provider just doesn't have the workforce in the right place at the right time. And so in some cases, households do pay for those line extensions or those additional things. And in some cases, they want to, and they're not actually even able to.
We heard from Senator Baldwin about the effort to map, you know, who needs what where. If somebody's out there listening, thinking, hey, I want to make sure I don't want to get overlooked in this process, are there ways they could check and make sure that, yes, they are on the list or their community is on the list of places we're paying attention to?
Absolutely. There's two places I would love to send them. One is nationalbroadbandmap.gov. And that's that federal map that sort of talks about if you're unserved or underserved. And so you can type in your address and you can look and see who your service providers are. And if you feel like it's incorrect, or that, you know, sometimes we've seen people where they have the dot where they live on their barn and they want to move it to the house, you can challenge that map and the FCC will work with you to correct it. And then I also would love to give a plug, the Wisconsin Public Service Commission. We also have a WISER, a Wisconsin Internet Self-Report, and that's just right on the PSC's homepage. And you can go and tell us, and that's a little bit more information. If people want to tell us that their internet's not performing as they expected, or it's really more expensive than they expected, or that it's not reliable and they're having outages, that's for people in the community that just want to give us a little bit more. And we're going to use all of that information as we go out and plan.
Alyssa, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Alyssa Kenny, Broadband and Digital Equity Director for the Public Service Commission of Wisconsin. She joined us to talk about the $1 billion plus dollars in federal funding Wisconsin is slated to receive over the next few years, aimed at improving broadband access in the state. Earlier, we listened to my conversation with Senator Tammy Baldwin, who is part of that announcement of the money coming to Wisconsin. Speaking of announcements, starting this Saturday, July 1st, if you listen to WPR on 90.9 FM in the Madison area, you want to move your radio to 90.5 FM starting Saturday. If you want to keep listening to the Ideas Network, 90.9 FM in that area, going to stop broadcasting. But good news, a more powerful signal on the way at 90.5 FM. Same stuff to listen to, but serving a larger area for listeners in South Central Wisconsin. Again, 90.9 FM, South Central Wisconsin, minus 0.4. 90.5 FM is your new home. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, celebrate nature by listening to it. check out some of the latest science on the benefits of sound in natural landscapes and figure out how to tune your ears to figure out what's going on behind the scenes in nature. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Jumping is a big part of sports culture here in Wisconsin, from jump around at Badgers events to the Lambeau Leap. But Milwaukee's hosting a competition where jumping is the main event. As reported by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, UW-Milwaukee's Panther Arena is hosting the National Jump Rope Championship. Competitors from around the country will compete in solo or double Dutch events. In each one, there's a speed category and freestyle. Speed involves speed, lots of jumps per unit of time. Freestyle allows for some creative dance and gymnastics. The event runs now through July 2nd. I've tried jumping rope a handful of times in my life, supposed to be good cardio. I'm not the most coordinated guy in the world, but when I've tried jump rope, I'm surprised at how very bad I am at it, like even by my usual standards of clumsiness. So best wishes to the competitors through the weekend, and know that even if you finish in last place, you're still doing better than I would. This is Central Time.